Welcome to The Nature of Florida, the Sunshine State's only podcast dedicated to its wild and natural places and the fight to preserve them. I'm your host, Oscar Corral. I've dedicated much of my career to making films about environmental issues. Tune in each week to hear from a broad range of voices, from scientists to surfers, activists to mermaids, who are working on the front lines to save what's left of Florida's natural beauty and its wildlife. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a new episode of the Nature of Florida podcast. With me today is District 7 Commissioner Raquel Regalado, the first Miami-born Hispanic woman to serve on the Miami-Dade Commission. Raquel, a lawyer by trade, is also the host of several radio and television programs in Spanish that focus on informing people about politics and local issues. Her voice on the Commission on environmental issues is usually moderate, a balance between the constant want of developers and industry and the vulnerable and priceless wilderness areas that surround Miami, Everglades National Park, and Biscayne National Park. Welcome, Raquel.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So let's start with some just basic stuff. You serve on the Miami-Dade Commission.
What is a native Miamian? Like, we have to explain that. We have to start. What is a native Miamian?
There you go. What is a native Miamian? I guess you and I fall into that category. What is it?
Listen, it's important because a lot of folks, you know, for many, many years, Miami was this transitory place, right? And one of the things that we try to explain to people as native Miamians, when we talk about the environment or we talk about infrastructure and, you know, the Everglades and all that stuff, is a lot of these folks have places to return to. You know, they're from somewhere else, you know? So when they think about what they're going to do with their kids and their grandkids, you know, they go somewhere else. Miami was a place where people came to play or to stay for a little bit while they waited, you know, to go back to wherever they were from. And I think that really explains to a lot of folks why there's such a difference between the native Miamian mindset, you know, and other Miamians. And although we always say, if you live here for more than 10 years, we'll adopt you as a native, you know, if you were born and raised here, this is your home. Like, you're not going on vacation to somewhere else. You're not spending Christmas somewhere else. Like, this is your home. I just turned 48 years old. I was born in 1974 in a very different Miami, you know? And when we talk to people about, like, the Miami of our childhood, the frustration is that our children and our grandchildren are not going to experience Miami as we experienced it. You know, things as basic as the trees, you know, and the landscape. I mean, I try to remind my fellow commissioners that are younger and the ones that haven't been here that long. When I was a kid, Miami-Dade County ended in Kendall Drive. Like, that was it. Like, that was no man's land, you know? It had a very small footprint, you know. I actually learned to ride my bike and roller skate on Brickell. Brickell was a safe street for kids to play in when I was a child because it only had three buildings and it had no lights. I tell people that growing up, the smell of mangroves was the smell of my childhood. Like, I want someone to put like the smell of sulfur in a candle because it reminds me of growing up, you know, in old Miami. Nice. And Brickell was full of mangroves. And now when, you know, people who came here recently complain about the flooding in Brickell, it flooded when I was a child, you know, and what protected it was these mangroves, you know. And, you know, one of the things that we try to explain to folks is that we've always had this tension between development and the environment here. And if you grew up in Florida, I don't know if you remember, but in fourth grade, we actually took Florida history. In the 70s and 80s. That was like a class. And I remember the first chapter of Florida history was the fight against water. And it really has been a fight against water. And now we face all these issues with water quality, with our aquifers. When we were kids, we had to learn our aquifers. And, you know, if you grew up in New York or you grew up somewhere else, you may not know about the Biscayne Aquifer. You may not know, you know, how limestone works, you know, in Florida and how, why it's so important not to pollute, you know, our environment, because it goes directly into a very shallow aquifer. So, you know, when you grow up in Florida, you know, everything from, you know, Everglades being a beautiful park to us and to other people, it's kind of like a mosquito infested, like, disaster, you know,
yeah.
We love it, you know, like, it's a place that we went as children, you know, and it's a different kind of take. And it's interesting because now our kids are native Miamians, but their experience is not our experience. They don't have access to the things that we had access to because we've grown so much and Miami has become so urban and so developed. And that's why we fight for parks and for trails, you know?
I would say, I would say that there is no urban area in the United States, in the continental United States, that is walking more of a fine line between the needs of developers and the vulnerability of environmental areas like Miami. Miami is the third densest skyline in the United States after New York and Chicago. And it is straddled by two national parks, Biscayne on one side and the Everglades on the other. Miami has nowhere left to grow but up. Add to that the possibility that it could flood with sea level rise in the next century, and it's a very vulnerable place. And yet, exactly as you said, Miami does not have this spirit of environmentalism traditionally. And I think it's exactly for the reasons you said that. It's such a transitory city. It's a transient place. It's a lot of people are itinerant citizens and residents who move here as a stepping stone in their career, as a stepping stone to another place they want to get to, or visiting from another country or from another state. I think that Miami has the potential to be one of the most environmentally progressive cities in learning how to mix and balance development and nature. It starts with people like you, people in leadership positions who are making decisions on a daily basis about what's going to happen. And so I want to ask you about that, Raquel. What is it like to sit in that seat where you are having to weigh these considerations on a regular basis between people and developers who want to come and do something, build something in Miami or develop an area, and then the Everglades, which is our water supply and also a place of international fame for its wilderness, pristine wilderness, or at least, you know, sometimes pristine wilderness, and, you know, Biscayne Bay, which is and Biscayne National Park, which are these beautiful jewels we have in our backyard that don't exist anywhere else in the United States. What's it like?
Well, you know, it's challenging because, like you said, I agree with you. I think that we are like the epicenter of these choices, right? I think in other places, people look at the decisions that government is making and they look out 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, and think, well, what are these decisions? How are they going to impact us in those decades? I think in Miami-Dade County, because of the contamination of the bay, because of the issues that we've had historically with the Everglades, because of our water system and how dependent we are on it, you know, we look at much shorter timelines, right? The decisions that we're making right now, like this year, we're like, yay, we didn't have a fish kill. I mean, that's like crazy talk, but that is where we're at. Like, our environment is that fragile, you know, that we try to explain to folks, like, listen, we didn't have a fish kill, but now the state of Florida found that the oysters are, you know, contaminated. And what is that going to cost, right? And how are we going to ensure that those habitats like survive? But at the same time, we have like the University of Miami and other partners, FIU is doing great work. And they're putting together really innovative things. Like, we're doing a lot of work here in terms of gray and green infrastructure, right? Like, how can we like mesh these two things? So FIU and UM are both working on seawalls that are part artificial, part alive, you know? How can we bring back, right, what we used to have in Miami-Dade County? One of the first things I did as a county commissioner was bring an ordinance to create a mangrove map that looks historically at where the mangroves used to be and tries to educate people on where we've lost mangroves and the correlation between the loss of those mangroves and flooding, right? Because people, when they see mangroves, they're like, oh, it's obstructing my view. Right. But you're like, whoa, it's protecting you from the water, you know? So, you know, and another thing that we talk about is elevation, right? So elevation, you know, flooding. We just had a small flooding incident, you know, and we didn't get nearly as much rain as we were supposed to. And we had serious issues here in Miami-Dade County. And one of the things that we're seeing, back to your point about development, is, you know, the houses that were built in the 30s, 40s, and 50s were elevated by several feet. and built on a bluff. Why? Because they knew that this place had the propensity to flood. You know, the development that was made in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, you know, before the change in the code in the 2000, had no freeboard. Right. So they're right, you know, at level. Now we're required, you know, a few feet of freeboard, but it's not nearly, you know, what they used to do decades ago. And as we look at creating a more resilient Miami, the question is, you know, are we doing everything that we can do to have that balance where we have development, but at the same time, we're aware of the impact that that development has. So, you know, right now we have a housing crisis and a lot of folks are using that as an excuse to kind of set aside these environmental issues and be like, oh, no, we have to build, you know, we have a housing crisis. But, you know, I'm a firm believer in that single family is not the future. I know that people don't like to hear that because people love single family. But as you were saying, it's not sustainable long term.
In Miami. Miami's out of land. I mean, unless you look at the urban development boundary, which we'll get to. But yeah, I'm with you. You're right. Miami is growing up vertically because horizontally, there's nowhere else left to grow in Miami. So denser development is going to be the only way to really expand if we're going to grow more housing here. There's no more fields left where we can just pave over a forest and build, you know, 1,000 homes. That we ran out of that decades ago.
But there is something, you know, that we try to talk to people about, because I think, especially with Hispanics, right? You know, when you start talking about environmental issues, you kind of lose people because it's just too much. It's just too much. Like everybody just feels like, you know what, that's going to happen like in the future. Like, what can I do about that? But, you know, one of the things we've been working at the county is educating folks on their landscaping and their landscaping choices. You know, we love our fruit trees. And you know, I have areas in my, you know, my district where we've taken out invasive plants and people get very upset because they have a beautiful canopy, but they're invasive and they're doing damage, right? And we need to plant native plants. We need to bring back those native plants that help us with the flooding, that help us with the mitigation of water, you know? It doesn't all have to be a fruit tree, nothing against fruit trees. You know, although I do get a lot of heat from my dad because one of my issues is that I don't like palm trees. They're not trees. You know, they don't help with anything. They don't provide anything to our environment. So when I sit as a commissioner on the zoning side, I don't count palm trees. You know, they don't count. I think they're completely ornamental. If you like them, great, you know. But as far as I'm concerned, and scientifically speaking, they're herbs, they're not trees, you know, they really don't help our environment. So, you know, we try to promote, you know, gumbo limbos, buttonwood. These are like fast growing trees that provide canopy and, you know, so there are things that people can do. You know, one of the anomalies that we're seeing is this like AstroTurf. People are loving this AstroTurf. You know, a lot of it is not permeable. The same thing with pavers, you know. We need to have permeable surfaces. So there are little things that we can educate people on, you know, so that, you know, the spaces that we have can be more friendly towards our environment and kind of work with our environment. But, you know, we are talking a lot about density and also, you know, we're moving towards density because economically speaking, it just doesn't make sense. You know, I mean, people just can't. We're having a lot of generational living. I'm bringing items, you know, that will promote, you know, everything from auxiliary units, you know, to in-law quarters. So, you know, this, again, speaking of like a generational change, you know, the new generation of Miamians can't afford to live here. So the question is, how do we change the way that we live so that they can reside here and so that we can reside here as we retire? Because post-pandemic, you know, we've had this tremendous influx of wealth and it really has changed the character, you know, of our real estate market.
I like what you're saying. You're pointing out a problem that so many communities wish they had, which is, you know, this is such a popular place and so beloved that where do we stick people who want to live here? I mean, there's so many people who want to move here, and that's a great problem to have. Miami's awesome. Miami's the best. There's no place like it in the world, really. It's such an interesting place and such an open place. It's so welcoming of different cultures and people. And so we have a good problem, which is that people want to come here and they want to move here. Gosh, that's amazing. But that brings challenges, as you're saying. And I think one of the challenges, which you hit upon earlier, is how to create environmental awareness among people who move here. And so I want to ask you, as for me, as a Cuban American growing up in Miami, I didn't really have a lot of exposure to environmental issues at home, to say the least. I mean, you know, maybe I'd go out and pick some oranges. My dad would ask me to pick some oranges from the tree in the backyard. Maybe that's about the extent of his interaction with trees. But yet I still found my way to becoming an environmentally conscious person over the years. It wasn't an overnight thing. So I want to ask you, how was your journey? What triggered that sentiment in you? Because I see that you're active on the commission as a voice of reason for environmental issues. How'd you get there?
Well, growing up Cuban American, like the environment is just not like on the radar. You know, that's the reality of it, you know. But because we played so much outside, you know, like our generation really got to be outside so much. I was talking to my older brother the other day because he was talking about how his kids make a mess of his house. And I was reminding him that we were never in our house. Like we came home, you know, changed our clothes, went out again. And as long as we were back by dinner, you would have dinner and then you would go to sleep. Like you spent the majority of your time like outside enjoying nature. And that's why I always tell people, you know, our generation is better with heat than most because we were like outside a lot. We didn't get a lot of air conditioning. So, right. And then in the summer, we played tennis outside, you know, we were always outside doing stuff. So for me, that was part of being a Miamian. Like I had every single birthday party at Crandon Park. I can't remember a birthday party that wasn't at Crandon Park, right?
How about El Farito? Come on, El Farito was also popular.
Yeah. We had like your cake and your friends and your abuela, you know, and here you were like in the beach. So I think as I got older, you started seeing the change. And for me, Andrew, you know, really was impactful. You know, Andrew was, you know, it was so devastating.
That's Hurricane Andrew in 1992, right?
1992. So it ripped through South Dade. You know, there was this massive exodus. And really, that's when people started talking about, wow, you know, we live in a fragile place. Like I hadn't seen that. You know, like you talk about hurricanes and you have viento plataneros, you know, you grow up in Miami and, but, you know, post Andrew, and then, you know, with the changes that we were seeing, you know, with sea level rise, with sargassums, the beaches started changing, the erosion, like the Miami that I knew was slowly disappearing. And for me, that was kind of like the wake up call, like, hey, wait a second, like what I love about this place may in fact disappear if we don't do something, you know? So I think, you know, as you get older, you have an appreciation for it, you know, and you become a steward. And one of the things that concerns me when we talk about the environment is that so many people politicize it now, because when I was younger, the environment and protecting the environment wasn't a Republican or a Democrat thing. It was a green thing. You know, everybody wanted to do it. It had not been, you know, polarized by anyone. And in fact, a lot of people don't know that, the EPA and a lot of these standards were started by the Republican Party. So I don't know at what point, like, it kind of went sideways. But, you know, I think it's important for folks to recognize that it is in everyone's best interest to protect the environment. It is in everyone's best interest, you know, to protect water quality. It is in everyone's best interest to protect the bay. The bay and our beaches aren't just important because we love them and we enjoy them and they're a part of our environmental landscape. They also are the drivers for our economy. That's right. You know, when tourists come here and they go to the beach and the beach is closed, you know, because it's contaminated, that impacts like our economy. So for us, it's an investment at this point. And I think like post, like after 40, I always tell people, like, I don't care why you do it. I just want you to do it. So I don't care why people protect the environment, you know, whatever your motivation is, whether it's economic, you know, or it's nostalgia, or it's scientific, like, I don't care what your motivation is, you just need to do it. And I think that's where we're at now, that it's a really like a call to arms, like people need to understand that there are things that have gone very, very wrong. And we need to make, you know, serious choices. You know, we talk about, you know, the UDB, which is, you know,
the UDB, the urban development boundary.
Boundary, which is under attack. But, you know, we have an issue with recycling. Recycling is a lie. You know, they stop recycling in Broward. We know that we're not recycling what people, you know, are putting in their trash cans here. It's very limited what we can recycle. You know, we have more trash than ever post pandemic, and we're really concerned about it. And we need to find better ways that, you know, we can deal with trash, and we have to educate consumers about what they use, because unfortunately, somewhere along the way, people thought that all plastic can be recycled. And that's just not true. Mm. And I can tell you from the county side, very little plastic is recycled. Mm. Actually, you know, we want your cardboard, you know, feel free, you know, to put the cardboard in the recycling bin. We'll take that, you know, but I think also the choices that we make, we have to be a little bit more aware that we are all stewards of our environment, and that, you know, you mentioned earlier that Miami is so cool, you know, and it is, we're so cool. We're so diverse, you know. But remember, and I always try to remind people of this. I remember English only. I remember McDuffie. You know, I mean, it was a very scary place for a, you know, series numbers of years. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I saw the first bumper sticker that said, "When the last American leaves Miami, take the flag." Yeah. And I thought, oh my God, they're going to take the flag.
Yeah.
I was a kid, right?
Miami was a tinderbox when we were growing up. It was very tense ethnically, for sure.
Yeah, but what happened, I think, is that people chose diversity. I think we made a choice, right? And the people who were not okay with that left.
Yeah.
And then the people who stayed were like, you know what? We choose diversity. We are going to support other groups. We're going to welcome other waves of immigrants. You know, the Anglos who were here, they learned Spanish. Everybody kind of just, you know,
coexisted, bought in. And now, you know, now we're one of the most, you know, interesting places in terms of just diversity, how different people are here, and yet all come together. And it's reflected in the commission. It's reflected in our elected leaders. You mentioned something that
But my point to this, and not to get you off track, but my point is, I think we have to choose the environment. You know, I think we have to choose to be stewards, you know, and I think that's where we're at now, where whoever is not okay with this, you know, can't really live here, because we have a lot of work that we have to do. And everybody kind of has to roll up their sleeves, you know, and do this work.
You mentioned something really interesting, which is that somehow along the way, environmentalism became a partisan issue, and it became a wedge issue, which I find to be strange, because everybody needs clean air. Everybody needs clean water. Without it, we're dead. And the only way we're going to get it is if we take care of the natural places that keep those things healthy, our water and our air. And so I think you have a certain advantage being a local leader, because in Miami-Dade County, races are nonpartisan. Like they are, local races are nonpartisan, like they are in many parts of the state of Florida. Many local races are nonpartisan. So I think that at those levels, environmentalism still is very much bipartisan. And so you have a lot of people who are from both parties at the local level who are coming together to speak out for the environment. It's when you get to the federal level and the state level. So, you know, the congressional races, Florida House and Senate races, that's where you start seeing that partisanship seep into environmentalism. And so, I think for somebody like you, you're in a position to really forget about the politics behind it and just focus on the issue. And so that has led to some really interesting things you guys are doing in Miami-Dade County. And one of them that I wanted to talk about is this interesting transition that you're doing. So you mentioned that a lot of the houses built in the 30s, 40s, and 50s were built in higher elevation areas or elevated up. But a lot of the development that came later on was built in lower lying areas with septic tanks. And septic tanks are these concrete boxes that are put in your yard. And that's where all your waste goes from your house. And the nutrients from that waste, the way that the septic tank gets rid of them is it leaches it into the ground.
Right.
And so in those areas, those nutrients are leaching into the ground, and that eventually makes its way into either the aquifer or the ocean or the bay. So Miami-Dade County has started a program now to transition some of those homes that have septic tanks to central sewer. In other words, so that the nutrients don't leach into the ground at the site of the home, but instead they're channeled to a central sewage processing location where the sewage is then cleaned out and then disposed of in a different way. we'll get to that later, because as of now they're dumping it offshore. But anyway,
ocean
that's outfield. A whole.
We got to talk about ocean outfill, you know, and right, deep water protection. So, and toilet to tap, also a great topic.
So in a nutshell, tell me, what's the county doing about, what's the septic to sewer? What is that all about? And how do you feel about it?
Well, I'm obsessed with septic tanks. I've been talking about septic tanks for many years. You know, here in Miami, we have so many of them, because what happened is, as folks went out, you know, past where the county had invested infrastructure, they just opened the well and tapped into the aquifer and then put in a septic tank. And then they just kept going and going and going. My first experience with a septic tank was when I was a baby attorney at Holland & Knight. I was a litigator for Holland & Knight, and I got called over the weekend to go to a client's house to pick up a disposable camera and go to a client's house. So that's like when you went to Eckerd's and you bought a disposable camera and you went over there.
I remember those days, sure. Yeah.
And what had happened is the septic tank had collapsed, you know? So they showed up and I saw like a septic tank, like open, and like, you know, what had happened is they had taken a car, had driven, you know, improperly into the area and on a part of the septic tank, and the thing had like gone all the way up. So it was like this huge, like box of waste, like covered like in palmetto bugs and stuff. It was something out of like a horror movie. And you could smell it for blocks and blocks and blocks. And that was like, I had heard about septic tanks, but I hadn't seen a septic tank. So, you know, I went through this whole litigation and this process, and I learned so much about septic tanks. And I couldn't believe that we still had, you know, these things like in our environment, because as you said, like literally the way they work is to, you know, leach this stuff like into the environment, you know, like that's literally how they were designed. They were not designed to contain this material forever, you know, and some of these septic tanks are decades and decades old. So I started learning more about septic tanks, and I found that the county actually had their first report on the damaging effects of septic tanks in 1973. Like, wow. That was the first time that the county commission, wow, like received
almost
an agenda 50 item.
Years ago. Wow.
Yes, like before we were born, right? Like before we were born, they were already like, yeah, these things are bad. We need to stop putting these things in, and we have to figure out a way to get rid of them. But Miami kept growing, and these areas, you know, kept, you know, expanding. And then you didn't have a line. So another septic tank and another septic tank and another septic tank. So my district is not the district that has the most septic tanks. It's actually number two. Number one is Monestine's area, which has the most septic tanks, but we're right behind him. And I've been talking about it for several years. I talked about it when I ran for mayor and now. And thank God for the Biscayne Bay report, because until we got to the Biscayne Bay report, everybody was like, oh, septic tanks are not so bad, Commissioner. But when the Biscayne Bay report comes out and says, no, actually, these things are contaminating our waterways, you know, all of a sudden we start, you know, talking about septic to sewer. So it is a monumentous task to get rid of these septic tanks because we have so many of them. But, you know, what I've been working on is looking at the rules that have prevented us from getting rid of them. So for example, one of the problems that we've had is if the water and sewer comes and puts a lateral, you know, and now you as a homeowner have access to that, you know, the minute they put down that lateral, you have 90 days to connect or you're in violation. Well, nobody can connect in 90 days. You can't even get a permit in 90 days. You know, that's a poison pill, right? And what about if you just got a brand new septic tank, you know, are you going to connect, you know, are you going to fight the county on it? So I'm actually bringing an item in September that makes a lot of changes. We spent 2 years kind of looking at all the county rules that have to do with septic tanks and figuring out what worked and what doesn't. We already approved a new requirement for septic tanks. So now people who put in septic tanks have to put in a fiberglass septic tank that actually has like a motor, you know, so I can't get rid of all of them, but I can make sure that the new ones that come in, you know, are better technology than what we had before.
Right. Cause there are more environmentally friendly septic tanks.
Yes.
Technologically advanced.
So now what we're working on is creating these special benefit districts and, you know, doing the funding so that we can go eliminating them neighborhood by neighborhood. And we're focusing on the ones that are near waterways or that we know are failing. And it's a huge process, but I also passed a moratorium on septic tanks in properties that the county owned, because I was like, what is the county doing proliferating septic tanks? Like, at a minimum, we can stop, you know? So we've had a moratorium now for a year and a half that I'm very proud of. So Miami-Dade County has personally not added any septic tanks because we were the biggest offenders. We were adding septic tanks in our affordable housing. Why would you give a septic tank, you know, to someone who can barely afford a house, you know? So we also started an education for septic tanks, a registry for septic tanks. Now septic tanks and wells are registered in the property appraisers and we're tracking them, you know, so that we know where they are and we have a map. And we've also, I did an overlay. So a lot of times what happens is water and sewer will tell us, you know, Commissioner, it's just too expensive to go into that neighborhood and put in a lateral. So we created a five-year map looking at what FDOT is doing, what FPL is doing, what the municipalities are doing, what the state is doing, and what we're doing so that when we tear up a street, we can come in and put a lateral. So now we have a way to, you know, make use, you know, of somebody else's project.
Sometimes FDOT or even the county, they might pave over a street and 2 years later, they'll decide to put a lateral on and they'll have to tear it up and pave it over again. I mean, this time that policy makes sense to at least put in a sewage line if you're going to pave over a street, because you don't have to pay the cost of, you know, paving over that street again once you put in a sewage line in a couple of years. It's a monumental task.
We did a pilot. So, you know, one of the things that we did is we worked with the city of Pinecrest. Pinecrest had wells for 40 years and it was super polemic. And it took us 8 months, but we worked with them and we did a pilot and we actually got rid of those wells and that project is almost finished. So we started with the wells, eliminating the wells, you know, because they're a little bit easier than the septic tanks. But now we're moving full on into the septic tanks. And that item is actually going to come before the county commission in September.
Wow. And it is a monumental task. From what I understand, there's like something like 3 million septic tanks in Florida, something like that. Anyway, yes. And in Miami, there's probably hundreds of thousands, or, you know, at least a couple hundred thousand, if not more, 200,000 or 300,000.
Yes, about 130,000 septic tanks.
130,000. So little by little, you're starting to chip away at that problem. Hey, you know, the journey of a thousand miles begins with the first step, right? So you've taken the first steps. That's important. And I know we're a little bit late, but there's so much tasks, so much to talk about.
If you hear noise in the back, it's my daughter who's making a lot of noise. So I apologize.
Oh, it's okay. We live in a Zoom world. I know it's, if my dog barks, I apologize too. Don't worry about it. Lastly, tell me how do you feel about Biscayne Bay, Biscayne National Park, and the Everglades? How do you personally feel about it? And what is your commitment to protect those areas?
Well, I grew up going to the Everglades. I mean, for us that grew up here, it was a place that you visited. It wasn't like a nuisance. Like, we all read Leaves of Grass. And then, you know, we went to the Everglades. Like, we all know the story. You know, I rode my bike down, you know, that trail a million times as you pass like the crocodiles, and then you learn that you could actually take your bike on the bus and you didn't have to ride all the way back.
Shark Valley, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, so, you know, we all learned our Shark Valley lessons. So, you know, I think one of the things that when we talk about Everglades restoration, thankfully the state is now really on board and we have a true partner at the state level. We've had more allocations, you know, for Everglades restoration in the last few years than we've had in the last 20 years. So finally they're like coming around. And I think environmental tourism is a thing. You know, it is a thing and we're promoting it and we're educating people about the Everglades and about the history of the Everglades. I think we have to do a better job with like our kids. Like when I took my kids to Shark Valley, like they weren't very impressed. But, you know, as we pass on kind of the mantle of stewardship, I think that we have to do a better job, you know, of getting our kids to love it as much as we love it. And the Bay, of course, you know, I think so many people were impacted by seeing the fish kills and the algae, you know, and that just kind of, you know, because like we were saying before, you know, you see these environmental issues as something that will happen in the future. So I think when folks saw the Bay dying, like right in front of us, yes, it was really a call. It was really a call to action, and one of the things that we're proud of is now, even as we do events in Miami-Dade County, for example, so, you know, Ultra came recently to the city of Miami and they had like an environmental specialist that actually like covered the drains, you know, and worked on the recycling and the impact that it would have on the bay. You know, we recently had the boat show, and I was physically there as a dolphin watcher. You know, we had, you know, we're trying to get folks to understand, like, you can have these events, but you have to protect the environment. You know, it cannot be like at the cost of the environment, you know, and then we use these events to educate people on the bay and the restoration that we need to do and the work that we need to do. So the septic tanks is a big part of our bay issue. But the other thing that we did is we passed an ordinance limiting the types of fertilizer that folks could use in Miami-Dade County,
right, because which was a great step, I think.
Huge issue with like the Roundup and the runoff, you know, and everyone loves their beautiful landscaping here. And their first response is to just spray everything at the worst possible time. So now in Miami-Dade County, you actually cannot use these products during the rainy season because of the runoff. And we're doing everything to educate people on everything from using rain barrels, you know, to ensure that they use the right type of water for their landscaping, to better landscaping that doesn't need all these chemicals, and how these chemicals end up in our water system and in the fish and in the oysters, you know?
That's one thing that regular people often wonder, well, what can I do to help the environment? Well, one thing everybody can do if you own a single family home is don't fertilize your lawn, xeriscape your house, plant native plants that don't require any irrigation or don't require any fertilizer. And that in itself will help because collectively that reduces a lot of the nutrients that are going into the bay and going into the aquifer. I mean, there's so much left to talk about, but I guess we're running up on our time limit.
We could do a part two.
You're one of the interviews that I need to do a part two with, because there's so much left to cover. But this has been a really, really great conversation, Raquel. And I want to encourage you to keep standing up for environmental issues and for these beautiful places that surround us that need voices like yours to defend them. And so I congratulate you for the work you're doing, and I hope you continue to stand up for these places. And I want to thank you also for participating in the podcast.
This episode of the Nature of Florida podcast was brought to you in part by the Everglades Foundation, the Felburn Foundation, the Fish and Wildlife Foundation of Florida, and Explica Media. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to subscribe on our website, thenatureofflorida.buzzsprout.com. That's thenatureofflorida.buzzsprout.com, or find us on your favorite platform and follow us on Facebook and Instagram.